And I brewed some coffee, boiled it in a pan, drank it right on down, ridiculously strong. I was bulging out from his skull, wired to the max. He drank it all. Coffee! OD! Coffee!
We tend to associate caffeine with coffee and to assume it originated in Arabia, when in fact the elixir of life for many of us comes in many different foods and drinks and hails from other places as well. Talking History's Eileen Dugan, professor of history at Creighton University, explores the history of caffeine with her guest, Bennett Allen Weinberg.
Modern society is hooked on caffeine. Whether coffee or tea, hot cocoa or cola or chocolate bars, we consume an astronomical amount of caffeinated products every year. Despite medical warnings about the dangers of too much caffeine, many still consider it an indispensable part of their lives. But how did caffeine enter our culture in the first place? How did this substance, this drug, become so popular and so accepted? With us today is Bennett Allen Weinberg, who, along with Bonnie Beeler, wrote the recent book, The World of Caffeine, The Science and Culture of the World's Most Popular Drug. Mr. Weinberg joins us today to talk about the history and enduring appeal of caffeine and caffeinated products. Welcome, Mr. Weinberg.
Hello, Eileen. Thanks for having me.
Okay. We tend to assume that, for example, coffee came from Arabia, tea from China. Is that true? Where did these products come from?
Well, it's kind of close to being true, but in fact, tea probably originated in northern India. And no one really knows for sure, but it certainly was an import into China, probably beginning around 6th century B.C. Coffee has somewhat of a mystery attached to it. It grows wild all across Africa, but no one really seemed to have encountered it within historical times until around the 15th century, when it suddenly surfaces in southern Arabia and the Yemen. When it was used by Sufis to sustain their devotions. But in fact, they probably encountered it just across the Red Sea in Africa and brought it back home with them.
How did these cultures, for example, the Arabs, mythologize the beginnings of coffee?
Yes, well, there are many stories about how coffee came into being. And in general, the caffeinated botanicals are associated with divine interventions. Shen Nung, the great Promethean progenitor of Chinese culture, who was supposed to have lived around 3000 BC, also supposedly was the one to discover the uses of tea as a pharmaceutical agent, as something that would restore your energies and pick up your wits, and also convey a variety of healthful benefits to you. And in the Arab world, they had similar legends about the gods intervening and supplying coffee to various people. The common legend that we hear about Kaldi, the shepherd, who was playing around in northern Africa and Ethiopia and saw his goats frisking about and realized that they had nibbled on some coffee beans, is actually a later European introduction.
How did kawa or coffee come to travel from northern Africa to the Middle East?
Well, as I say, no one's quite sure. It was believed the best explanation is that the Arabs who were living both in the Yemen and in Eritrea encountered coffee and it's growing naturally and somehow stumbled upon its stimulating effects and simply brought it back with them right across the Red Sea. The mystery of it is that the Arabs actually had contact with tea. Centuries before they knew about coffee. And it's quite strange to think that coffee really remained hidden to the world until the 15th century, because as soon as it was encountered, within about 100 years, it had covered the entire Arab and Islamic world, and then within another 100 years, it covered the entire world. So it's just odd to think that the ancients who knew, the ancient Greeks, for example, knew the names of the Ethiopian tribes by name, but they had no idea about coffee.
When do we begin to see coffee houses in the Arab world?
Right from the start. The Sufis were of the laity, and although they were a religious group and they got together and did their devotions nightly, they took the knowledge of coffee back home with them. And it spread rapidly through society. And almost immediately, coffee houses began to open up. They looked a lot like the coffee houses that we think of today, except that there weren't any women around. They weren't allowed in. But apart from that, they were places where people could meet with members of different classes of society, could get the news, could possibly listen to some late entertainment, and in general have a nice relaxing time and conversation. However, it should be noted that in the Arab world in those days, that was quite a revolutionary institution, and it was not approved of by any means by everyone. In those times, there was no similar place where people could meet. People didn't go out, as we're used to doing so, to restaurants and so on. And they more or less confined their entertainments to private circumstances. So this was really quite a revolutionary institution. And it was opposed both for that reason and for the reason that it was purveying what might be considered a beverage that was contrary to the Quran, that the coffee houses were repeatedly closed, repeatedly the subject of injunctions. You see, the Quran, of course, prohibits the use of intoxicating beverages. And some people noticed that caffeine has its own little stimulating effect. They called it the markaha, their word for the caffeine high. And some of the more conservative religious people said that it must be banned for that reason alone. But they were really, in the end, unsuccessful at stopping the progress of coffee.
Well, going from coffee to the subject of tea, how did China become acquainted with tea?
Well, as I say, probably through interactions with the people in northern India, was very early associated with various religious practices. And in fact, I should comment that the caffeinated botanicals, wherever they were encountered, seemed to have had a connection with religion, but also they were regarded as strong drugs. They were not regarded as we do them today, as we regard them today, as comestibles. That understanding of coffee, for example, came much later. Initially, where coffee appeared in Arabia and in Europe and tea in China and so on, it was regarded as a drug, a very strong drug, and it was prized for its uses as a drug. So the Chinese first became acquainted with it as such, and it was considered to be an indispensable constituent of the elixir of life, the potion of immortality, and figured into Taoism and into its ritualistic uses into Confucianism, and later into Chan Buddhism, which finally gave rise to the Zen tea ceremony in Japan.
And how did it come to be associated with the power of emperors?
Well, in China, teas were grown. There were very rare teas cultivated and sought out, and the emperor of China at one point used to send people to climb mountains to harvest remote sources of tea. When they used to throw rocks up at the monkeys, who would then shake branches, and the tea leaves would fall down, which they would collect and bring back to the emperor. An extremely expensive way of preparing a brew, but one that emphasized the emperor's royal status.
So we have coffee, we have tea, and let's move to Mesoamerica and talk a little bit about cacao and chocolate drinks. Was there evidence for that in early Central America?
The earliest direct physical evidence of cacao is in a bowl that is from about 600 AD, but other evidence, a little more indirect, indicates that it was first cultivated and used by a group of people called the Olmecs, who were the predecessors of the Maya. And they made cacao a very important part of their lives, and it was considered to be something that only mature people had the capacity to enjoy properly. And they grew it, and they enjoyed it, and very little is known about these people, but probably around 1000 BC, they were already cultivating the plant.
How did they value the cacao bean in, for example, the Maya and the Aztec groups?
Well, it was regarded actually as a kind of money, and cacao beans were prices were actually set in terms of the number of beans. The daily wages of a laborer were calculated in terms of the number of cacao beans, the price of a fish, the price of other food items. And in fact, strange to say, perhaps, the caffeinated botanicals have often been used as currency. Coffee beans have been used that way in Egypt, and in the Far East, tea has been pressed into bricks and stamped and used as money as well. Another indication, the fact that it was used as currency is an indication of its tremendous intrinsic value, and especially a recognition of it as a drug. Because drugs, for example, cocaine today is still used as a kind of currency in certain areas, as is opium.
What role did cacao have in the religion of the Maya and the Aztecs?
It had a strong role in the Mayan religion. They made it a part of their rituals. They undertook human sacrifices. For example, they would feed cacao drinks to the people that were going to be sacrificed with the idea that their hearts would become transformed into a cacao pod and that they would be suitable then for release during sacrifice. And it was part of their rituals and part of their priestly undertakings to drink and serve cacao. The Aztecs really made it more a part of their martial practices. It was really considered something that only soldiers who had gone through combat would have the right to enjoy. And even the members of the royal family were not supposed to use it until they had been proven in battle. So it was a very important feature of their lives. And again, as I say, it was understood as a drug. It was understood as something that affected the mind and increased the powers of thought and observation. And also, of course, it gave you tremendous amounts of energy.
Is that why Montezuma II was such a big fan of chocolate drinks?
Well, yes. It was considered a part of, as I say, their martial culture. And it was prized as an adjunct to military activity, and it would be used by them, by these peoples, as well as in Africa and other places, by warriors and raiding parties to keep them going during the exertions of their enterprises.
When did Europeans finally make the acquaintance of caffeinated drinks?
Well, it was really in the 16th century that Europeans first began to encounter coffee and tea, really at about the same time as it happens, and cacao as well around the same time. The first caffeinated botanical to reach Europe was, oddly enough, was cacao, not coffee or tea. The Spanish learned its uses and began enjoying it quite a bit of time before the other European nations caught on with coffee and tea. And they tried to keep the secret to themselves, although ultimately unsuccessfully. Travelers, scientists, merchants returned from the Middle East, from the Far East, with the stories of coffee use and tea use and the coffee houses and all the medicinal benefits of these drinks. And the Europeans were very interested in trying them out for themselves.
When did the first European coffee houses open?
Again, very shortly after the discovery of the drug by the Europeans, the first coffee house in London opened up in 1650 in Oxford, and it was followed within a few years by a coffee house. The first coffee house in Oxford opened up in 1650. It was followed in a few years by the first coffee house in London, and very quickly it became an extremely popular institution throughout England. A pattern that was followed very shortly thereafter by the other nations in Europe. And again, its story of its inception in England, I think, is quite fascinating. William Harvey, the great physician and discoverer of the circulation of the blood, was really a coffee pioneer. He attended the University of Padua in 1598, and he encountered the uses of coffee. We're not sure whether from other students in that very international place at the time or from botanists who were beginning to write about it. But he became so enamored of coffee that he arranged to have a private supply delivered to him in England, and for the rest of his life he continued to consume it. When he died, he left his stock of coffee to the members of the London College of Physicians, instructing that they drink a toast in his honor until the supply ran out. It's even said that he thought of the idea of the circulation of the blood when he had had too much coffee and felt his blood pounding in his ears. But perhaps an even more fascinating story is the fact that the Royal Society of England, which is one of the great scientific societies of the world today, began as an Oxford coffee klatch. And a few scholars, scientists, academicians, writers prevailed upon a local pharmacist to prepare and serve coffee weekly at his establishment. And they met there, and it was not in order to enjoy the flavor of coffee, which was prepared in a manner that was bitter, murky, and rather unpleasant. It was because they saw in it a psychoactive drug that would augment their mental activities. And in a way, kind of like how marijuana was used in the 60s by college professors and so on. I mean, it was thought of as an exotic drug from a foreign land. And unlike marijuana, however, caffeine really does seem to augment mental prowess. And it's just been confirmed through modern studies. And they brought their coffee tippling to London. They got a royal charter, and ever after became the Royal Society.
Well, we only have a minute remaining, I'm afraid, but how would you describe caffeine culture today?
Caffeine culture today is more pervasive than perhaps than it's ever been in the history of the world. Over 90% of the people in the world use caffeine regularly, which is an astonishing record of consumption. And it's used in virtually every nation in the world, and it's popular in all age groups, in both sexes, in every station in society. And I think in a very important sense, it's become the defining drug of our time, and one which we're having recourse to help us cope with the demands of modern life. Information intensive, scheduling demands become heavier and heavier, and there's no doubt that caffeine helps us to regulate our energies, our activities, and sharpens our mind and improves our performance. And things like the computer culture, caffeine is the cult drug of the computer world. And there's no question that it actually does improve the ability of people who are doing things like programming a computer to solve problems, to concentrate on their work, and even to input things with a keyboard more precisely and quickly.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Weinberg.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Bennett Allen Weinberg, co-author of the recent book, The World of Caffeine, The Science and Culture of the World's Most Popular Drug.
Nikolai brewed some coffee, boiled it in a pan, drank it right on down, ridiculously strong. Eyes bulging out from his skull.